This is the second of two tapes that have been made on the life of Mr. Green of Haddenham, Mr. Jack Reeve of Streatham, and Mrs. Mabel Demain of Haddenham also. And we now bring you the conclusion of Mr. Reeve's story on this particular tape, and after that we shall hear from Mrs. Demain, the late Mrs. Demain. On tape one is the full length interview carried out by Kevin with Mr. Green, and about 7/8 of the programme on Mr. Reeve can be found also on tape one. So without further ado, we'll continue where we left off and go back to the year of 1979, when myself and Errol Spur, who now runs Castle Homes in Ely, a big estate agent, went along to interview Mr. Reeve at his home in the High Street of Streatham.
You said the banks were a lot higher in those days.
The old banks were shrunk a lot.
How high would they be if you went down the Sarum Road? Because, I mean, it's fairly flat now, isn't it? This is
what the banks are, they?
This is down the Sarum Road, is it?
Yeah, down the Military Road,
yeah.
They
ain't very high
now. No, but they were a lot higher.
Oh, yes, they ain't done them up since they done that. They've got New Dyke at, or that place at Denver Sluice.
Denver Sluice, yeah.
They've done the big dyke there. They've never been no trouble since.
No. And you're telling me when you went down the road to the pumping stations, which is a long lane,
yeah.
You said you wouldn't have got down there in those days.
No, what was that? Big stones down, you see.
Why did they do that then, Jake?
Well, the carts, when they used to go down, they used to make little wheels just cut in like they would on a drove, really.
Oh, I see.
They used to put these big old stones in to keep them up.
In other words, they used to fill the big old stones to fill the ruts in the road.
Yeah, you wouldn't have got down there.
And what else can you remember about the old days at the local village, Jack? In the way that... when did the new people start coming in the village? Was it before?
Well,
it'd
be 1928 when they started. They built them up there. They come. There were some fresh new ones come then.
Yeah, and what area did they come from? Did they come from?
Oh, some came from London.
Some came from London.
Yeah,
Were these evacuees? Or?
No, they just retired and come down there.
They retired.
They got people live here. You see, released and live this way, so they got them down here.
Yeah, and that was the start of the
increase,
increase in the population, yeah.
And then, see, that this last, well, it was 9-10 years, they built about 50 round in the field round the back.
Medicroft,
yeah, bungalows and areas, you see that, they're all strange as far as I know that way.
Yeah.
I shouldn't know any of them.
And how many do you think of the old villages are left now? Is there many of the old villages left that
what,
you
people?
Know?
Yeah. Oh, yes, there's a nice lot left yet,
There's still a few of the old gang left.
Because they're a nice friendly bunch.
Oh, yes.
I've been in the Red Lion.
Very
well with them. In fact, they raised us, they kicked Fen Probe off. Money which was raised in the Red Lion.
Yeah.
In a bottle, I think it was. I think it was around £1. That was the start of the tape service.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've got to be thankful to the people of Streatham.
Well, they started off up there, aren't
they? Yeah, well, they started us off. I think Jack's covered really everything, don't you? I mean, he's covered his old times.
Yes, the old times, the new times.
Yeah.
What he used to earn in the old days.
I ain't told him all I've done.
That's probably a good thing, Jack.
Yeah. Are you going to have a cup of tea before you go?
We will do. Can I just finally, though, thank you very much.
Yeah, that's quite all right.
For giving Errol and myself this interview.
Yeah, that's very nice. Thank you very much. If that's going to help somebody, I don't mind doing that.
No, thanks a lot, Jack.
Appreciate
it.
I'm
sure our listeners will find that very interesting. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Country live. when I was a child, there were three old customs kept up in the village. They were the means of raising small sums of money. They were goodenin, ploughboying, and mayladying. Widows went round on goodenin day. I do not now know how it originated, but on the 21st of December, the shortest day of the year, widows in ones and twos went around knocking on doors, where they were given small sums of money or a packet of tea or sugar. Only widows were allowed to take part in this, and one year old Jinny Croxon joined the collectors. We all knew she wasn't a widow. It was true her husband was often ill and unable to work. When she came to our house, her right to join the widows was challenged, and she promptly replied, "I'm worse than a widow woman." Widows were really poor in those days and had a hard life. There were no pensions, and often their poverty was acute. Sometimes they got some small parish relief, a mere pittance, and it meant pleading poverty and almost begging, and these women had their pride. I can remember one woman who was left a widow with an invalid daughter to keep. She went out washing and became bent almost double through bending over the wash tub. There was the hard scrubbing to be done, and then the ironing. A full hard day, several times a week. No washing machines or electric irons in those days. We used to see her going home, her stooping figure, looking so tired and weary after these wash days. Goodenin Day, coming just before Christmas, provided them with a little extra for the festive season. Then, in January, there was Plough Monday, which was called Ploughboys' Day. I think it was originally meant for ploughboys only, and they carried a decorated plough around when they did their collecting. Boys always wore heavy, hobnailed boots with heel and toe plates and studded with hobnails. What a noise they made! You could hear them coming a long way off. They ran around from door to door. Sometimes they came after dark and would carry a raby lantern tied to a long pole. It was made by making a big hollow in a raby wurzel and cutting a window in the side where the light from a lighted candle shone through. Then on May the 1st it was the girls' turn to go round mayladying. They all carried dolls. There was great competition with the dolls. They all had as pretty and as well dressed a doll as possible. The girls knocked on the doors and greeted everyone with, "Please can you spare a copper for a maylady?" My mother wouldn't let me go mayladying. She said it was only a form of begging. Oh, and how I envied the other girls who were able to take part in this activity, especially when they told me of their financial results. This collecting was supposed to end at midday, and so the little girls often stayed away from school in the morning, going from door to door. Then there was another old custom. It was tolling the church bell for any death in the village. The bell tolled three times for a man, and twice for a woman, and once for a child, with short intervals in between. This custom had to end at the outbreak of World War I, because orders went out that church bells were to be used as a warning of enemy invasion only. Then years ago we also had a town crier, and he went around the village with his bell and announced all important functions, sales and public meetings, and lost property. Whenever we heard his bell, usually in the evening, we rushed to the door to hear the crier slowly shout his news. This custom also ended at the outbreak of war. Until then, for many years, it was carried out by George Chapman. He was a little man with a big voice, and he still lives in the village with his wife. They are lovable country people, and his bell is one of his most treasured possessions. Now, war comes to Haddam. During World War II, there was plenty of activity in our village. Not only was labour short, men and women were fully occupied by work on the land. They also had to fit in many duties connected with the war effort. The Home Guard enlisted a number of men, and under the training of two old soldiers, William Rushbrook and Albert Goodkiss, they were put through their paces. And what a difficult task for these two elderly but active officers. My brother reached the position of corporal, and he often recounted some amusing stories about some of these raw recruits. They hardly knew their left foot from their right. One dark winter's night, the company had a special exercise which involved blacking their faces and getting camouflaged and creeping along hedges and about the lanes and fields. Going home after this activity, my brother, completely forgetting his blackened face and dishevelled appearance, and armed with his rifle, he went home to his wife, who was so scared by the spectacle, promptly passed out in a dead faint. An outstanding member of the Home Guard was the village fishmonger, Frank Bristow, a big burly man with a loud voice. He had been a sailor in his younger days. He could often be heard from a long distance at his post outside the local post office, challenging those who came anywhere nearby. He used to say, "Friend or foe?" Even people he knew well and lived nearby received this same challenge, and with his rifle at the ready, one dare not ignore this request. What a queer sight these men were, with their ugly, ill-fitting khaki uniforms, so often looking like comic soldiers. The air raid wardens looked far smarter in navy blue suits and peaked caps and berets. They paraded the streets every night, and woe betide anyone who showed the tiniest glimmer of light. I think they enjoyed their position of authority, and with the village policemen made sure that even keyhole lights were not visible. At the outbreak of war, the local policeman, Sergeant Lees, who was on the reserve list, was called up. Sergeant Lees was a likeable, pleasant man who married a teacher from the village school and was happily settled in the police house only a very short while before he was called up. After only a few weeks, the sad news was received of his death on active service. He was one of the first casualties. A former village policeman, an elderly retired constable, took over the duties until the end of the war. He was PC Alfred Hudson. Early on, a very enthusiastic branch of the Red Cross was formed, run by Dr. and Mrs. Fairweather. They organized classes for the members. The lodge, Dr. Fairweather's home, was its headquarters. In fact, the lodge became the busiest house in Haddam. Not only was it the first aid post, but the big business of organizing homes for the evacuees was done there, with all the problems involved in that undertaking. Mrs. Fairweather was tireless and hard working. It was amazing the amount of work and organising she did. One day she said to me, "You know, I've got into a dreadful state. If I sit down and do nothing, I get such a guilty feeling." Her house was chock-a-block full of blankets, gas masks, first aid equipment, stretchers, clothing and food for evacuees. The evacuees sent to the village were mostly Jewish, from the East End of London, the Whitechapel slum area. I shall never forget one of the first coach loads to arrive. They came on a Sunday afternoon. They were a number of expectant mothers with young children. With their gas masks and bundles of belongings, they were a pathetic sight, frightened and bewildered. And although they were given good homes and every care, they could not settle. They missed the noise and bustle of Whitechapel, with its fish and chip shops, its cinemas and pubs. And before a week had passed, many had returned home, preferring, as they said, to be bombed out in London than to stagnate and die of boredom in a quiet country village. However, the staff and scholars of a London East End school settled in more successfully, using the church hall as their school. The children, with their own teachers, found it easier to adapt themselves and made friends among the village children. Another worthy scheme in operation during the war was run by a willing band of volunteers. It was the pie scheme. With the restrictions and rationing of food, it became increasingly difficult for housewives to satisfy their hungry families. Packed meals for the farm workers and others became a problem, and this pie scheme was a great help. Twice a week, hundreds of jam turnovers were made and baked in the local bakeries, and these were distributed to many families at a nominal charge. I can remember how we met in Steele's Bakery and in Jane Addams' club room to make and bake these turnovers, and we really enjoyed this very worthwhile job. Apart from the weekly collections made from door to door for the Red Cross funds, we had several public auctions. Any saleable gift was brought to the sale. Such a variety of goods, live and dead articles. Everyone contributed something. The farmers and gardeners gave produce and livestock. Housewives made gifts and turned out their cupboards, and anything they could spare from their homes was given. An auction sale I can remember especially was held on a lovely summer's day in the doctor's paddock at the lodge, and George Green was the auctioneer. Greeny, as we called him, was well known for his ability in auctioneering. He had plenty of cheek and a quick wit and sense of humour. One hardly dare move a finger or nod a head in case Greeny took it for a bid. He also had a habit of knocking down some odd lot to anyone time and time again, and then putting them up again for sale to good-natured and generous bidders. In this way, large sums of money were made. I can remember that old pram. It was sold over and over again before he finally knocked it down to me. And to everyone's surprise, including the cheeky auctioneer, I paid the pound and kept the pram. One of these auction sales realised over £1,000, and although they entailed a great deal of voluntary hard work, they were very enjoyable. With the great help of the local schoolmaster, Mr. Bert Miles, and his assistant teacher, Mrs. Collin, Mrs. Fairweather also organised war savings collections, and thousands of pounds were raised, and many people were persuaded to turn out their hoards of money for the war effort. Collections were made weekly throughout the village, which was split up into districts, again worked by voluntary collectors. And it was amazing. Special weeks were set apart, like War Weapons Week, when extra efforts were made to meet tremendously high targets. Several army units were stationed in the village during the war, and many of the men were billeted with local families. A Yorkshire regiment, the RAMC, and an American searchlight party all stayed quite a while. We ran a canteen for the men and provided snacks and a few home comforts for them. They made friends and received real Fenland hospitality. As time went on, there were several weddings of local girls and these men, and some still live in the village, and others went to America to settle. Searchlights were used a great deal during the war, moving across the sky at night to search for the enemy planes. I remember when they were first used, my father went down the fen early one morning to find a number of frightened and excited gypsies on the cut bridge. They could not understand what was happening. Something was happening to the heavens, they said. They knew all about the moon and the stars, but these frightening, glaring lights flashing about the sky caused them much alarm and kept them awake. It took my father some time to explain to them and calm their fears. Farmers had land army girls and prisoners of war to help on the farm. And grass fields were ploughed up, and every bit of land was used to grow more food. We had ration books for food. There were shortages. Sugar, fats, and tin goods from abroad were in short supply. Chocolates and sweets, ice creams and lollies were just not obtainable. Children's teeth must have improved. Iron railings from the front of the local churches and houses were taken up to be used in ammunition works for the war effort. And some of these railings had been handmade by local blacksmiths, and it seemed a shame for them to be removed. I had a lovely old grandfather, my grandfather Chapman. He was a dear old man, we all loved him. Well, my granny died, and then on Sundays he used to go and spend Sunday dinner and tea with some elderly relatives in Hillrow. Well, after he'd had his dinner, I used to always go and have my dinner with them too. After dinner, Grandad used to disappear, and I would be about 10, I should think, and I wondered where Grandad had gone. But I didn't realise until afterwards that he'd gone courting, because eventually, after a year or so, he married the woman next door. Her name was Rosina. So, but we got very attached to old Rosina. We never called her, she wasn't our granny, but we called her Granny Chapman, because we were all little children. We called her Granny Chapman, and she was very kind to my grandfather and looked after him ever so well. Well, after some years, quite a few years they had together, Grandad died, and we all kept interested in Granny Chapman. She left the farmhouse where they lived, the Elms, and she went to live in a council bungalow. And we used to go and visit her quite often because we liked her. Anyway, during the war, when there was a shortage of clothes, we had clothing coupons to get clothes and shoes. She wanted a pair of boots. She never wore shoes. I never saw her with a pair of shoes on. She always wore men's boots or boys' boots, but during the war she wanted a pair of boots. And she asked me if I would get her a pair. She didn't realise how difficult it was. I tried Ely and St Ives and all the shops everywhere. Rachel tried everywhere to get shoes, went to all the shops around. We even went to jumble sales. And her neighbours tried. We all made a big effort to try and get these shoes, but they were just not obtainable. And Granny Chapman said, "Oh dear, I don't think you're trying." She said, "If only I could get out, I could get some boots, I'm sure." She didn't realise, you know, that they were difficult to get. It was through the war that we had such a job to get any article of clothing. Anyway, as time went on, we got so we dreaded going to see her because she kept nagging about these boots. But one day I went, and she looked so pleased with herself. She said, "I've got me boots." Well, I knew she never went outside the house, so I said, "Got your boots? How did you get them?" She said, "Yes, I've got them myself." She said, "You wouldn't get them and Rachel wouldn't get them. Nobody would get me these boots, so I got them myself." I said, "Oh, whenever did you get them?" She said, "Well, I wrote up to Mr. Barrett." Well, now, in those days, there was a firm called Barrett's of Northampton that made boots, and all the advertisements, it used to say, "Walk the Barrett Way." Very old firm it was. And she said, "I wrote to Mr. Barrett, and I said to him how badly I needed these boots, and nobody could get me any. I wondered if he looked through his factory, whether he could find the sort I wanted. I told him the size." And she said, "I had a very nice letter come back from him to say, 'Well, I've looked through my factory and I think I've got just what you want. If you send me the money, I'll post on the boots.' And that's what happened. She sent back the money and he sent the boots. And as you can imagine, she was very delighted to think that she'd got them. She was a remarkable old woman. I can remember once she walked to Ely. She never missed going to Ely Fair. She loved to go to the fair. And she would walk across Grunty Fen. And one day I remember she said that somebody in a motor car stopped to offer her a lift. But no, she said she wasn't going to be picked up by any strange man. So she carried on walking herself. But she loved living in the Elms. It was a big house in Lode Way. It's been pulled down since those days. But it was a lovely old house. It had two stairs. It had a huge whitewashed kitchen. And you could sit in the open half, at a low half, and like ingle nooks, and look up to the stars. And if it rained, because it would rain down on you sitting in the fireplace. There was a copper in there and the sink. I believe there were two coppers and a sink. It had a brick floor. I know it was whitewashed. And they had hams and bits of sides of bacon hanging up in the kitchen.
And she used to break her own bread? Or did she buy from a baker?
No, she wouldn't bake her own bread because there was only her and Grandad, you see.
Yeah.
But they cooked. They did all the cooking on this low hearth.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, they did that. And there was a big dairy too. And two stairs.
We are approaching the end of side one. When the music finishes, please turn over the tape and side two will begin almost immediately.